So think about a newborn foal for a second.
Okay, like a baby horse.
Yeah, a baby horse. It just drops out of the womb, hits the grass, kind of shakes itself off, right? And within maybe an hour, it is standing up.
Wobbling around a bit, but yeah.
Exactly. And within a few hours, it's walking. By the end of the day, it can literally run alongside its mother to escape a predator.
It's pretty incredible when you actually think about it.
It is. Now, compare that to a human baby. I mean, a human baby is essentially born entirely premature compared to other mammals.
Utterly helpless.
Utterly helpless. It cannot hold its own head up. It can't find its own food. It requires years, and I mean literally years, of constant, exhausting, intricate care just to survive, let alone become an independent adult.
Right.
We are, from a purely biological standpoint, one of the most vulnerable and just absurdly dependent creatures on the
Oh, well,
planet.
without a doubt, we are fragile.
Right. And yet, this wildly helpless species somehow managed to build civilization, split the atom, wire the entire globe with supercomputers.
Which is quite the leap.
It's a massive leap. How did we do that? Usually, when we try to answer that, or really when we try to figure out why our modern world feels so profoundly broken right now, we look at humanity like a mechanic looks at an engine. We assume there is a broken part. We say, oh, human nature is just fundamentally greedy, or, that specific economic policy is a dead spark plug. If we just swap it out, the machine will run perfectly again.
Which is, a very comforting way to view existence.
It really
It
is.
gives us this illusion of control. We want to find the bad part, swap it out, and just assume the entire complex system goes back to a baseline of normal.
Right, a quick fix.
Yeah. But if there's anything we have learned from studying human systems, it's that we are no mechanical engines at all. I
Yeah.
mean, you try to swap out a bad habit in your personal life, or a government tries to force a new policy, and suddenly everything else shifts around it.
In completely unpredictable ways.
Unpredictable and often highly destructive ways, yes.
So, if we aren't machines, what are we? And why does it feel like we are constantly building systems that just make us miserable?
That is the million-dollar question.
It is. And that is the mission of today's deep dive. We are stepping entirely outside of that mechanical, broken part worldview today.
We have to.
Instead, we are unpacking a profoundly ambitious academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saley. The paper is titled Whence Come and Whither Go.
It's a heavy title.
It is a heavy title, and I know it sounds like a purely philosophical thought experiment, like something you'd ponder over a glass of wine, but it is actually a really rigorous, grounded exploration of biology, culture, and this concept he calls civilizational repair.
And I think we need to draw a hard line right away here.
Okay, lay it out.
This exploration is not about detached mysticism. Dr. Saheeli is attempting to answer two of the oldest questions humanity has ever grappled with:
Yeah.
where do we come from and where are we going?
Right. Whence come and whither go?
Exactly. But he isn't looking at humanity from the outside like an alien studying an ant farm. He is looking at it from inside the messy, breathing, physiological reality of living. And to do this, he draws heavily on the work of systemic biologists and thinkers, specifically Humberto Maturana and Simena Davila.
Two incredibly dense thinkers.
Very dense, but brilliant.
Yeah.
And he uses their work to argue that humanity's future, our survival really, depends entirely on the manners of living that we are actively choosing to conserve today.
Okay, let's unpack this because the core claim here is just staggering to me.
It turns everything upside down.
It really does. This framework suggests that much of our modern suffering, like our anxiety, our global conflicts, or ecological crises, none of that is an inevitable result of human nature.
Right, it's not baked into our DNA.
Right. It is a cultural trap we've built for ourselves. And more importantly, by understanding the actual biology of how we relate to the world, we are given a roadmap to get out of it.
That's the civilizational repair part.
Exactly. So whether you are listening right now trying to comprehend macro things like geopolitical warfare, or you are just tasked with fixing a toxic corporate culture at your office, or honestly, you're just trying to heal your own personal relationship,
It applies at every scale.
every scale, the frameworks we are going to explore today are designed to fundamentally alter how you interact with the world.
But it requires a complete paradigm shift.
Okay, where do we start?
To build that paradigm, we have to start with that first ancient question: whence come?
Yeah.
Where do we come from?
Okay.
The framework states, quite simply, that we come from life.
Sounds obvious enough.
It does, but
Yeah.
we have to be very careful with that word. Life in this context is not a mystical spark. It is not a poetic metaphor. It is not even just a collection of DNA.
So what is it?
Dr. Salani roots his entire argument in Maturana's strict biological formulation. He defines living beings as molecular autopoietic systems.
Okay, I'm going to need you to slow way down there.
I know, it's a mouthful.
Molecular autopoietic systems. That is a dense wall of jargon. Let's peel that apart. Autopoiesis.
Yes.
The root words there are auto meaning self and poiesis meaning creation or production, like poetry.
Right, autopoiesis. Self-creation.
So it just means self-creation.
Well, let's look at the mechanism. Imagine a factory.
Okay, I'm picturing a factory.
A normal factory takes in raw materials, let's say steel and rubber, processes them, and outputs a product, like a car.
Right.
So the factory produces something other than itself. Now imagine a bizarre self-contained factory where the only thing it produces is the factory itself.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it takes in raw materials, and its internal machinery constantly repairs the walls, builds new conveyor belts, and generates the energy needed to keep the factory running.
But the output is just more of the factory.
Exactly. If the factory stops at producing itself, it ceases to be a factory and just becomes a pile of rust and metal.
Oh, I see.
That is an autopoietic system. In the molecular domain, a living cell is a closed network of molecular productions. It continuously produces the very structures that allow it to continue existing as a discrete unity.
It produces its own boundary. It produces its own internal components.
Yes. It is distinct. It draws a line in the universe and says, this is me. And outside of this is not me.
Okay, that makes sense. I am a closed system.
But here is the massive paradox that drives the entire rest of this biological framework.
There's always a catch.
Always. While the living being has a boundary and is distinct, it absolutely cannot exist apart from the environment that makes its living possible.
Wait, I'm stuck on this boundary concept. Let's test this.
Okay, go ahead.
If I need oxygen constantly to fuel the cells in my body, like if I go a few minutes without it, my factory shuts down completely, right?
Right.
So does that mean the oxygen in the room is part of me? Like, where does my boundary actually end?
It's a vital question. The oxygen is not you. The air in the room is not part of your molecular autopoiesis. You are a closed system. But, and this is the key, your closed system requires a very specific medium to survive. Davila and Maturana gave this intersection a specific name. They call it the eudeon.
The eudeon. U-D-E-O-N.
Yes. That stands for Organism Niche Ecological Dynamic Unit.
Organism Niche Ecological Dynamic Unit. So the organism and its niche are a single unit.
They are a conceptual unit. The niche, the temperature of the room, the oxygen, the gravity, the social field you inhabit.
All the stuff outside of me.
Right. All of that is not you. But that niche is absolutely essential to the continuous realization of your living. You cannot separate the two. They are distinct, but not separate.
So it's like trying to understand a tornado by only looking at the wind.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Think about it. If you study a tornado, you can measure the wind speed. You can look at the funnel cloud. You can say, there is the tornado. It has a distinct boundary.
Right, you can point right at it.
But if you completely ignore the atmospheric pressure, the hot and cold air colliding, the temperature of the ground that allows the tornado to exist in the first place, you don't actually understand the tornado at all.
No. You just understand spinning air.
Exactly. You can't separate the event from its environment.
I really want to highlight that tornado analogy because it exposes the massive blind spot of modern civilization.
How so?
Well, for centuries, our science, our medicine, and our economics have tried to understand human beings as isolated individuals. We study the wind of a person.
We sequence their genetics.
Exactly. We map their isolated psychology, we measure their individual productivity, and we completely ignore the atmospheric pressure of their eudeon.
Mm-hmm.
We ignore the niche.
We treat them like they exist in a vacuum.
Yes. Viewing life as an isolated individual, totally separate from its environment, is the first major civilizational mistake identified here. Life is not an object. Life is conserved organization in organism niche coherence.
Organism niche coherence, meaning the organism and the environment have to fit together like a key and a lock.
A perfect dynamic fit.
And if they fit together over time, we get into this concept of structural coupling. And I have to admit, when I read this section in the paper, it completely upended how I thought about evolution.
Let's test that. How do you normally think about evolution?
Well, I think of it the way we are all taught in middle school biology, you know?
Survival of the fittest.
Right. The environment is this harsh, static arena. It gets colder or food gets scarce. The environment poses a problem, and the organism has to mutate. Like it has to grow thicker fur or longer legs to adapt to the environment. The environment commands, and the organism adapts or dies.
A very one-sided Darwinian simplification.
But that's what we're taught.
I know, but structural coupling asks us to look much closer at the mechanism. It says that evolution is actually a historical drift of congruent structural change.
Congruent structural change.
Yes, the organism and the medium undergo reciprocal perturbation. They change together.
What does reciprocal perturbation look like in practice? Give me a tangible example.
Think about an earthworm.
Okay, an earthworm.
The earthworm doesn't just adapt to the soil. As the earthworm lives, eats, and moves, its biology fundamentally alters the chemical composition and aeration of the soil.
Oh, right. It leaves behind castings, it makes tunnels.
Exactly. The earthworm creates the environment that the next generation of earthworms adapts to. The organism changes the medium, and the medium changes the organism. It's a mutual dance of co-creation.
It's a continuous loop. We aren't just reacting to a dead world, we are mutually shaping each other.
Which leads to a really crucial realization. In this evolutionary dance, what exactly is being passed down from generation to generation?
I would assume genes.
It is not merely organisms, and it is not merely genes. A living lineage conserves a manner of living. We inherit a specific way of structurally coupling with our world.
We inherit a manner of living. Okay, if we take that as our baseline, that a species is defined by the specific manner of living it conserves, then we have to ask the big question.
What made us human?
Right. What was the specific manner of living that birthed humanity?
This is where we move from pure cellular physiology into relational biology.
The messy
A
stuff.
very messy stuff. If you ask the average person what made humans dominant, you usually get a story about aggression.
Yeah, of course. We are told our humanness was forged in domination, in the hunting of big game and outcompeting other primates, or at least in our unique ability to build weapons and tools to conquer our environment.
That's the classic narrative.
And I have to raise a red flag here.
Go for it.
Because as someone trying to reconcile this, the survival of the fittest narrative makes logical sense to me. Our ancestors survived ice ages, they survived saber-toothed tigers, they survived famines. You don't survive a harsh prehistoric world just by being nice.
Oh.
But this framework, drawing on Maturana and researcher Gerda Werdenzeller, argues that humanness didn't arise from aggression. It claims it arose in love, play, and languaging. And frankly, are we really saying tenderness made us human? This sounds like poetry, not biology.
I completely understand the skepticism. It sounds like, wishful thinking.
A bit overly optimistic, yeah.
But it is deeply grounded in physiological observation. Let's go back to your opening example about the newborn foal versus the human baby.
Okay.
Gerda Werdenzeller spent years studying early mother-child dynamics, specifically looking at that intense vulnerability. That prolonged childhood, which is called neoteny, is the biological key.
Kneeling to.
Yes. Because human infants are utterly helpless for years, our ancestors were forced into a manner of living that required constant intimate coordination just to keep the offspring alive.
Right, because you can't just drop the baby and go hunt alone.
You can't.
You have to carry it, feed it, protect it for years. So you need a tribe to support you.
Yes. And what Werdenzeller observed is that the human self does not begin as an isolated, calculating point of consciousness. The self is a relational achievement.
A relational achievement. I like that phrasing.
In that extended intimacy, born from touch and food sharing, our ancestors developed an incredibly complex, recursive coordination of doings and emotions. They had to constantly signal to each other, read each other's physiological states, and play.
So the extreme vulnerability of our babies forced us to coordinate. And that constant, nuanced coordination of actions and emotions is the biological root of what we eventually call language.
Precisely. But notice the shift here. Language didn't evolve simply as a tactical tool to point at a mammoth and say, kill that.
Right.
It evolved as a way of living together. It evolved from play and intimate coordination.
Yeah.
And at the absolute core of this relational dynamic is the concept of love.
Okay, but we have to be careful with that word.
I'm very careful. We have to strip away centuries of romantic cinematic baggage from that word.
It's not a rom-com.
No, definitely not.
What a
Maturana
Sandman.
defines love not as a soft sentimentality or a grand passion. Biologically, love is the relational domain where the other is accepted as legitimate in coexistence.
Let me make sure I understand that. accepted as legitimate in coexistence, that means I am not trying to change you.
Right.
I am not demanding that you perform a certain way to earn your space next to me. I simply accept your existence as valid alongside mine.
That is the strict biological definition. Without that specific relational domain, without the ability to accept another without demanding they serve a transactional purpose, our large brains would have just made us highly efficient, solitary predators.
We'll just be really smart sociopaths.
Pretty much. But because our biology was structurally coupled with this intimate extended care, love became the defining condition of our humanness. It is the relational space that allows our physical bodies to realize themselves.
Wow.
Which brings us to a foundational concept introduced by Davila and Maturana. They call it cultural biology. And we need to pay very close attention to the fact that they spell it with a hyphen.
Cultural biology. The hyphen connects the two words. Why is punctuation so critical here?
Because that hyphen marks a distinction without a separation. It is the eudaimon applied to our social reality.
Okay, break that down.
Conceptually, we can distinguish between biology and culture. We could talk about the nervous system, hormones, and cellular repair over here.
That's the biology. And we can talk about cultural norms, religious beliefs, and economic expectations over there.
That's the culture.
But existentially, in a living human being, they are inseparable. Your culture enters your biology.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the paper introduces Samina Davila's concept of culture as the second womb.
A very powerful metaphor.
It is. Because we are all born from a mother's biological womb, obviously. But the second we take our first breath, we are dropped into a cultural womb.
Mm-hmm.
And this cultural womb is preloaded with distinctions. It already has rules about what is good, what is bad, what success looks like, who is considered worthy, and who is considered disposable.
Yes.
And we absorb this wound long before our brains have the capacity to use language or reflect on what is happening to us.
This is perhaps Davila's most profound discovery regarding human suffering. As a systemic family therapist, she realized that much of the deep, intractable pain humans carry is not a biological malfunction. It's not a broken spark plug.
Exactly. It is culturally generated. Think about a child born into a culture, a second womb, that explicitly conserves the distinction that human worth is directly tied to economic productivity or academic perfection.
But the child doesn't inherently know that. They aren't born with the biological drive to get an A on a math test.
No, of course not. But the cultural womb constantly reinforces it.
Yeah.
So if the child struggles, if they fail to meet that external standard of perfection, they don't just think, oh, I made a mistake.
Right.
Because the culture equates performance with worthiness. The child internalizes an existential invalidation. They feel they are illegitimate in coexistence.
They lose the biological domain of love.
Yes. And here is where the hyphen in cultural biology becomes terrifyingly real. They live this undeserved cultural devaluation as if it were an absolute truth of their own biology.
I really want to dig into the mechanism of that, because it's easy to just say, oh, culture hurts us, you know? But how does an abstract cultural idea literally alter our biology?
Let's trace the actual physiology.
Okay.
The child internalizes the belief that they are unworthy. Now, the brain, which evolved to keep the organism safe within a tribe, perceives this social invalidation as a literal threat to survival.
Because if the tribe rejects me, I die.
Exactly. The amygdala fires. The nervous system shifts into a chronic state of sympathetic arousal, fight or flight. The body floods with cortisol and adrenaline.
Just from a bad grade.
Just from the cultural invalidation. And over time, this chronic stress alters digestion. It suppresses the immune system. It changes the person's physical posture. The abstract cultural expectation literally reshapes their molecular autopoiesis. The culture becomes tissue.
They start to believe the pain is just who they are. They go to a doctor, they look at their anxiety or their chronic stomach issues, and they think, I'm a broken engine, I need a pill to fix my bad spark plug.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, their biology is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It is structurally coupling with a toxic cultural niche.
Exactly. It is a perfectly functional biological response to an incoherent cultural demand.
So, if culture acts as this invisible trap that wounds us on a cellular level, how do we possibly break free?
Right. How do we escape the second womb?
Yeah. If we are structurally coupled to a society that tells us we are only worth what we produce, how do we change the dance?
This brings us to the uniquely human capacity that serves as the hinge for the entire framework of civilizational repair. And that capacity is reflection.
Reflection.
Reflection is the specific operational moment when the cultural womb finally becomes visible to itself.
Let's spend some time defining reflection, because in everyday language, reflection just means sitting by a window, staring at the rain, and pondering your life choices.
Like daydreaming.
Yeah, daydreaming. But the framework is talking about something much more mechanical, isn't it?
It is a very specific operational mechanism. The paper draws on Pilbunnell's concept of the double look.
The double look.
Think about how we normally live. In ordinary living, we simply act out our inherited cultural cosmology. We don't see our beliefs. We look through them.
Like a window.
Yes. But reflection is an arrest in living. It is a deliberate pause. In that pause, we look at what we are doing, and then we take a double look.
Yeah.
We observe our own observing. We realize that the world we are seeing is fundamentally shaped by the distinctions we ourselves are making.
I tried to visualize this when I was reading the paper, and I thought of it like this. Imagine you've been wearing a pair of blue-tinted glasses your entire life, literally since the day you were born.
Okay.
Because you've never known anything else, you genuinely believe the world is blue. The sky is blue, the grass is blue, your mother's face is blue. That is just reality.
Right.
But then one day, you accidentally bump the frames, you feel them on your face. That is the arrest in living.
You notice the filter.
Yes. You take the glasses off, and for the first time, you see the glasses themselves. You realize the blueness wasn't an absolute reality of the universe. It was just a distinction, a filter that you inherited.
That is a double look.
And now, in that moment of reflection, you have a terrifying but liberating choice. You can put the blue glasses back on, or you can try to look the world without them.
That analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. Reflection is not an escape from culture. I mean, you can't step outside of your biology. But it is culture becoming recursively open.
What does that mean?
It allows a society or a company or an individual to stop unconsciously repeating its destructive habits and ask a radical question. What world does this distinction bring forth?
Like, if I keep wearing these blue glasses, what am I failing to see?
Exactly. If I keep measuring my child's worth by their grades, what relational reality am I destroying?
But the text is also very clear that reflection isn't automatically a force for good.
It's not.
It gives a really stern warning about the need for domain discipline. It argues that without discipline, our human capacity to make distinctions becomes incredibly dangerous. What happens if we lack that discipline?
Majorana's work warns against the danger of collapsing what he calls flat world realities.
Flat world realities.
Human beings are brilliant at creating distinctions. Every distinction we make brings forth a domain of validity. Chemistry is a valid domain with its own rules.
Right.
Economics is a valid domain. The legal system is a valid domain. But suffering arises when you take a distinction that is useful in one specific domain and you force it onto the entirety of human existence. You flatten a complex, multidimensional reality to a single metric.
Let's ground this in some real examples, because the ones mentioned in the paper were really stark.
Okay, let's hear them.
Think about education. Standardized testing is a valid domain. It can measure a certain type of rote memory.
Sure.
But when we lack domain discipline, we collapse the entire reality of education, the curiosity, the socialization, the mentorship, into test scores.
We flatten the student.
Exactly. Or look at healthcare.
Yeah.
A blood panel is a highly valid biological distinction. But when a hospital system reduces a patient entirely to their lab values and billing codes, ignoring their psychological state and their UDON, the system has flattened the human being.
They become a spreadsheet.
Right. Or in the workplace, when we reduce personhood to economic productivity, in each of these cases, you are taking a valid tool, a metric, a test, a financial model, and letting it devour the entire human experience.
And when a partial distinction becomes a totalizing reality, life is inevitably negated. The human being is erased. This is why Dr. Saley insists that the fundamental orientation of our reflection must be love.
Going back to that biological definition.
Yes, we must return to that definition. Accepting the other as legitimate. If you reflect, if you use the double look, but you do it without love, your reflection just becomes a sophisticated tool for domination.
How so?
You analyze a population's data just to manipulate their voting habits. You diagnose a patient just to streamline an insurance payout, completely stripping them of their humanity.
So love is the only thing that keeps our reflection humane. It keeps our boundaries and our metrics from becoming prisons. The paper suggests that this life-saving reflection takes shape in what it calls liberating conversation. What does a liberating conversation actually look like?
A liberating conversation is a space where you listen to another person without prejudice, without an agenda, and without demanding they conform to your flat world metrics.
You just let them be.
You open a relational space where they can finally see their own cultural conditioning. They realize that the cultural pain they've been carrying, the belief that they are broken or unworthy, is not their true nature.
It's just a pair of blue glasses they were forced to wear.
Exactly. In that space, they recover their self-respect. And if we connect this to the macro level, this is how entire civilizations mature. They learn to step out of flat world reductionism. They learn to integrate different domains, science, economics, art, biology, without reducing one to the other.
Okay, we have covered immense ground here. We've established where we come from, this molecular autopoietic dance, the eudaimon, our humanness birthed in vulnerability and love, shaped by a cultural womb.
That's the whence come.
That's the whence come. And we've seen how the mechanism of reflection allows us to pause and choose our path. Now, we must pivot to the second half of the paper. We have to answer the second ancient question.
Whither go?
Whither go? Where are we as a global civilization actually heading right now?
The paper introduces the answer with a premise that is simultaneously chilling and deeply empowering.
Right on me.
It states, we go toward what we conserve. Hope does not determine our future. Conservation does.
Wow. I need to pause on that sentence. Hope does not determine the future. Conservation does. That cuts right through so much of our political and social rhetoric.
It really does.
You can hope for world peace all you want. You can give speeches about it, write songs about it. But if your daily actions, your budgets, and your institutions are actively conserving fear and division, you are heading toward war.
The hope is irrelevant. The conservation is destiny.
That is the hard systemic truth. A lineage, a species, or a civilization only continues as long as a specific manner of living is conserved. So if we want to know where humanity is going, we cannot listen to what our leaders hope for. We have to look at what our institutions, our economies, and our politics are operationally conserving every single day.
And when Dr. Saheeli runs this diagnostic on our modern world, he identifies four major civilizational traps that humanity is currently stuck in.
Four traps.
Yes. He defines these traps as necessary distinctions that have become completely blind to the life they were originally meant to protect.
Okay, before we dive into the mechanics of these four traps, I want to be very explicit with you, the listener. As we unpack the geopolitical, financial, and sometimes religious elements of these next sections, we are maintaining strict neutrality.
Absolutely.
Our mission today is to dissect the systemic architecture of these traps. We are not endorsing any political ideology. We are not taking sides in historical debates or current global conflicts. We are looking purely at the underlying mechanisms of how human systems trap themselves.
An essential disclaimer, because these traps operate at the most volatile intersections of human society. Let's examine trap one, the Thucydides trap.
The Thucydides trap.
Dr. Saheeli defines this as security conserved as fear.
Okay. Traditionally, the Thucydides trap is a term from political science. It refers to the historian Thucydides, who observed the Peloponnesian War. The basic idea is that when a rising power threatens to displace an established power, conflict is almost inevitable.
Yes, that is the traditional structural view. But Dr. Saheeli deepens the analysis significantly.
Oh, so?
He argues that the true trap is not merely the geopolitical rivalry or the shifting of borders.
Mm.
The real trap is the conservation of a specific relational paradigm, a security model where fear becomes the master distinction.
Okay, let's look at the mechanism of that.
A state makes a valid distinction. We need to secure our borders to protect our people.
That's a totally normal, life-coherent goal.
It is. But when that need for security gets severed from the goal of mutual flourishing, fear takes over.
And when fear organizes a state's worldview, how does that alter its behavior?
Everything shifts. Every action by a neighboring state, even benign ones, is interpreted through the lens of worst-case scenarios. Deterrence becomes the only accepted version of realism. Diplomacy and dialogue are viewed with deep suspicion, seen merely as manipulative tricks or signs of weakness. But the most dangerous mechanism of all is this. A state begins to believe that the only way to guarantee its own safety is to actively manufacture insecurity for its neighbor.
You try to make yourself safe by making your neighbor terrified.
Exactly.
But mathematically, structurally, that is a doomed strategy. Think about it. If I point a weapon at my neighbor to make him afraid so he won't attack me, his structural response won't be submission.
No, of course not.
His response will be to build two weapons to make me terrified, which forces me to build three. It is a completely closed feedback loop. The initial desire for safety actually engineers permanent, escalating danger. Fear becomes the conserved manner of living.
Precisely. The original tool of security has devoured the possibility of legitimate coexistence. That is the Thucydides trap.
Which brings us to a trap that operates on a more daily level for most of us. Trap two, the Midas trap.
Ah, the Midas trap.
I want to take the lead on unpacking this one because the mechanics of it perfectly explain the profound unease so many people feel about the modern global economy. The framework defines the Midas trap as what happens when we conserve, claim sovereignty over the life ground.
Let's break down that terminology. What does he mean by claim sovereignty?
Let's think about financial claims. Money, debt, property rights, stock options, derivative contracts.
Okay.
Originally, humans invented these abstract financial claims as coordination tools.
Mm-hmm.
Money is a brilliant invention. It allows a farmer and a blacksmith to trade value without having to swap three chickens for a horseshoe. It coordinates labor.
It is a tool.
But the trap snaps shut when these abstract financial claims become more protected, more prioritized, and more sovereign than the actual biological reality that supports them. The soil, the water, human health, community stability.
When the map becomes more important than the territory, the paper notes that in this trap, life is forced to justify itself to money rather than money serving life.
Exactly. I want to use an analogy here to explain how this mechanism works. Imagine you own a car and you want to keep it running for 20 years.
Okay.
You will prioritize its long-term health. You'll change the oil, rotate the tires, drive it carefully. That is the life ground. But now imagine you are a corporation renting out that car and your only goal is to maximize the financial yield of the asset this quarter.
Oh, I see.
You don't care if the engine burns out next year as long as the daily rental fee is collected today.
You extract the value until the system collapses.
Yes, and we see this mechanism operating everywhere. Look at the global housing market. The biological function of a house is to provide shelter, safety, and a niche for a human eudaimon to flourish. That is its life ground value.
Right.
But in the Midas trap, housing is transformed primarily into a financial asset, a claim. It must first satisfy a hedge fund's need for quarterly yield. If it happens to provide shelter to a family, that is a secondary byproduct. But its primary conserved function is to generate financial throughput.
That's a powerful example.
And we see the exact same inversion in healthcare. The life ground goal is healing. But in a Midas system, healing takes a backseat to the optimization of billing systems and insurance claims.
We see it in ecology, too.
Oh, absolutely. Where a 500-year-old forest is literally calculated as being worth more dead, processed as timber, than it is alive as a complex ecosystem, we have let the abstract financial tool become the absolute master of our biological reality.
It perfectly mirrors the tragedy of King Midas.
Right. The guy who wished everything he touched would turn to gold.
Yes. He celebrated until he tried to eat, and his food turned to metal. He starved to death, surrounded by financial abstraction. We are structurally starving our ecosystems and our social fabrics because our institutions demand they be turned into capital.
Wow.
Which leads us to trap three, sacred insecurity. This is perhaps the most tragic and deeply entrenched of all the traps. It describes the systemic disaster that occurs when wounded ultimacy is conserved as violence.
Wounded ultimacy. That phrase implies that human beings possess an intrinsic need for ultimate concerns, like things we hold as sacred or absolute.
And we do. This is a vital part of cultural biology. Human beings cannot endure a purely utilitarian existence. We organize our relational domains around ultimate concerns.
Like what?
This could be a concept of the divine, a profound historical connection to a specific geography, a fiercely protected national identity, or the sacred memory of ancestors.
So things that give us deep meaning.
Right. In themselves, these are profoundly meaningful distinctions that provide social cohesion. But the trap mechanism engages when these finite, sacred concerns become inextricably fused with collective trauma, historical grief, and a rigid demand for absolute purity.
So the sacred identity gets infected by a historical wound. The trauma becomes part of the religion or the national mythos.
Yes. And when wounded ultimacy becomes the conserved manner of living, the entire landscape of human interaction changes. Suddenly, compromise is no longer viewed as a pragmatic political necessity. Compromise is framed as a profound moral betrayal.
Because you're betraying the sacred.
Exactly. To share the land or to reconcile with a historical enemy feels like you are erasing the suffering of your ancestors or defying the will of the divine. The other is stripped of their legitimacy. They are no longer a neighboring eudaimon. They are an existential demonic threat to your sacred purity.
And once that flat world distinction is locked in, it creates a mechanism that allows otherwise moral, compassionate people to rationalize unspeakable violence. It allows the suffering of civilians to be justified as a tragic but necessary holy duty for the protection of the sacred identity.
It's devastating.
Memory itself is weaponized. Religion, which theoretically should bind humanity, is conserved as a tool of absolute cultural exclusion.
It creates a vicious, self-sustaining loop. The grief from past violence becomes the moral permission slip to inflict new violence, which creates new trauma for the other side, ensuring the wound is passed to the next generation.
A completely closed loop.
Yes. Again, looking through our neutral systemic lens, you can observe this exact mathematical cycle operating in almost every intractable conflict across the globe. Mm. It is not fundamentally an issue of people being inherently evil. It is the tragedy of a sacred distinction that has completely lost its connection to the biology of love.
Which sets the stage for the final trap, trap 4, misrelevance. To be honest, misrelevance sounds almost benign. It sounds like a clerical error compared to the threat of geopolitical war or financial collapse.
I know, the word sounds mild.
But Dr. Saithley argues that it might actually be the most pervasive and insidious trap of our time. Misrelevance is what happens when a highly capable society optimizes all the wrong signals.
It is the trap of profound distraction. It is the systemic act of measuring, optimizing, and obsessing over data that does not actually matter for the conservation of human life.
Let's look at how this operates in the real world. We are living in an era of unprecedented technological power. We have massive supercomputers, artificial intelligence, and armies of brilliant data scientists. But look at what we point those tools at.
Social media algorithms.
Right. Think about the algorithms running global social media platforms. These are some of the most sophisticated pieces of engineering in human history. But what are they mathematically instructed to optimize? They optimize for engagement.
And human neurology dictates that anger, outrage, and fear drive the most engagement.
Exactly. So the algorithm successfully hits its metric, time on site goes up, ad revenue skyrockets, but the social fabric of democracies is torn apart in the process. We optimized the metric, but we destroyed the niche.
Or consider macroeconomic indicators.
Oh, this is a big word.
A government might point with immense pride to a chart showing rapid, sustained growth in gross domestic product, GDP.
The line on the graph goes up. The metric is a success.
Right. But the GDP calculation completely ignores the fact that achieving that growth required the permanent depletion of topsoil, the pollution of vital watersheds, and an epidemic of burnout among the workforce. The society is measuring its success using data that obscures its own biological collapse.
We are highly intelligent, but completely misrelevant. We are meticulously rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and ignoring the iceberg.
Dr. Saithley refers to this specific trajectory as a drift toward intelligent collapse.
Intelligent collapse.
It's a chilling concept. A society might be perfectly administered. Every spreadsheet might balance perfectly. The AI algorithms might be operating at absolute peak efficiency. The legal codes might be flawlessly enforced. But the actual breathing, physiological living conditions of the human eudaimon are quietly suffocating in the background.
The trap is that the wrong things have been conserved as mattering most.
Precisely.
When you lay out these four traps, Thucydides, Midas, sacred insecurity, and misrelevance, they paint an incredibly grim picture. The paper uses the phrase organized disintegration.
We are falling apart.
But we aren't doing it by accident. We're doing it in a highly organized, heavily funded, institutionalized way.
It would be an entirely despairing framework if the paper stopped there. But Dr. Saithley, anchoring his work in the biology of Maturana and Davila, doesn't leave humanity stranded in the traps.
Thank goodness for that.
Because these are systemic loops of our own creation, they can be uncreated. He offers a practical systemic way out, a path he calls the Great Corrective.
The Great Corrective. This is the pivot. We are moving from diagnosing the terminal illness to discussing the prescription. How do we actually escape the momentum of organized disintegration?
Escaping the traps requires a shift in our manner of living. Specifically, it requires the conscious, disciplined conservation of what he calls life-coherent distinctions.
Let's break that down. We know that as languaging humans, we can't stop making distinctions. We have to draw boundaries. We need laws, we need money, we need scientific metrics, we need borders.
We do.
So how do we make a distinction life coherent?
A life coherent distinction is a tool that operates in service of the eudaimon. It is a distinction that reveals a truth without reducing the complexity of the whole. It is a metric that measures a specific outcome without forgetting the vital things that cannot be quantified.
So it doesn't flatten the world.
Exactly. It is a political boundary that secures safety without imposing permanent structural insecurity on the neighbor across the line. It is a cultural memory that honors historical wounds without sanctifying a desire for revenge.
It's about putting the tools back in their proper place in the toolbox. We don't have to throw away the hammer. We just have to stop treating every fragile human interaction like a nail.
That's a great way to put it.
The framework talks about returning our systems to life service. The economy is a brilliant tool, but it must be placed in life service. The Udeon should not be in service to the economy. Technology must operate under life protective constraints.
But how do we actually implement that? Dr. Saley knows this requires more than just good intentions. To make this actionable, he provides a specific tool, the Life Coherent Distinction Test, detailed in Appendix B of the paper.
A test.
It is a rigorous set of diagnostic questions that anyone can apply to their own domain, whether that is a global policy, a corporate strategy, or a personal relationship.
I think we need to role play this test so the listener can see exactly how the mechanism works.
Let's do it.
Let's take a common scenario from the corporate world. Many large companies use a system called stack ranking for performance reviews.
Ugh, stack ranking.
Managers are forced to grade their employees on a curve, ranking them from best to worst, and the bottom 10% are routinely fired every year, regardless of their absolute performance. The goal is to maximize productivity. Let's run stack ranking through the three diagnostic questions.
Okay, I will pose the first diagnostic question. Huh. What does this distinction reveal and what does it obscure?
Okay, if I am the manager, stack ranking reveals exactly who generated the most direct revenue this quarter. It highlights individual throughput.
And what does it obscure?
It completely blinds me to the collaborative health of the team. It obscures the employee who spent hours mentoring a new hire because mentorship doesn't show up on their individual sales quota.
Right. So the second question, what manner of living does this distinction operationally conserve?
Well, the company claims it conserves excellence. But structurally, if I know I have to beat my coworker to avoid being in the bottom 10%, I am not going to share information with them. I am going to actively undermine them.
So operationally,
the system conserves fear, hyper-competition, and mutual distrust. It destroys legitimate coexistence.
Which brings us to the final, ultimate diagnostic question. Whose life capacity is protected and whose is diminished by this distinction?
The life capacity of the corporation's short-term stock price might be protected, but the physiological and psychological life capacity of the employees is vastly diminished. They are flooded with cortisol, they are operating in chronic fear, they are alienated from their peers.
Therefore, the conclusion of the test is absolute. Stack ranking is a life incoherent distinction. It flattens the human being into a single metric of throughput, and it destroys the social niche.
It fails the test.
Yes. If a company wants to escape intelligent collapse, that policy must be revised, restrained, or entirely abandoned. This is what returning to life service looks like in practice. It is the operational, systemic form of love.
You know, by running that test, you realize how liberating this entire framework actually is. It removes the paralyzing burden of moral blame. So often, we look at a toxic workplace or a broken political system, and we just throw our hands up and think, people are just inherently bad. Humans are naturally greedy and violent.
But they aren't.
No. This paper reframes our biggest crises not as the inevitable failings of evil individuals, but as systemic loops. They are inherited flat world distinctions that we simply need to stop conserving. We aren't broken engines waiting to be scrapped. We are living unities caught in a toxic dance. And because it's a dance, we have the capacity to change the steps.
That realization is the very essence of reflective choice. We are not passive victims of the universe. We're the active generators of the worlds we live in. We don't need to be infallible gods to fix our civilization, but we do need to be fiercely, rigorously conscious of what manners of living we are choosing to conserve.
To synthesize this incredible deep dive, let's look at the immense arc Dr. Saheeli's paper, Whence Come and Whither Go, has taken us on. It is a journey from the microscopic origins of our biology to the macro future of our species.
We answered Whence Come. We come from living relation. We emerge from the Udeon, the inseparable, continuous bond between the autopoietic organism and its niche.
We are the result of an evolutionary structural coupling that prioritized neoteny, mother-child play, intimate languaging, and the biology of love.
We are born into a cultural second womb that permeates our very physiology, shaping our nervous systems with distinctions long before we can even speak.
But through the profound power of reflection, that double look, the moment we realize we are wearing the blue-tinted glasses, we can see the cultural traps that are suffocating us.
We can see how we've let structural fear dictate our security paradigms.
We can see how we've allowed abstract financial claims to overwrite our biological needs. We can see how we've weaponized our sacred wounds into cycles of violence.
And how we've optimized our brilliant technologies for misrelevant metrics that simply do not matter for human survival.
And we answered, whither go? Because we inevitably go toward what we operationally conserve, our future is nothing more than the historical drift of what we choose to practice today.
If we harness the discipline of domains, if we rigorously apply the life coherent distinction test, and if we reorient our institutions around the biological mandate of legitimate coexistence, we can actually change the drift of humanity.
We can move from organized disintegration to civilizational repair. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to step out of the macro theory and address you, the listener, directly. Take a hard, reflective look at your own daily life right now.
Examine your personal metrics for success.
Are they rooted in life coherence? Or are you trapped in your own personal Midas trap, treating your body like a rental car, valuing your financial output over your long-term physical and mental eudaimon?
Are you stuck in a misrelevance loop?
Yeah. Measuring your worth by the amount of digital engagement you get instead of the actual grounded connection you bring to your local community? Are you treating yourself and the people around you like broken machines that just need to be fixed? Or are you tending to the eudaimon, the environment, the atmosphere, the manner of living you share?
It is a profound, life-altering shift in perspective. You are not a machine. You are a living unity.
And so, we leave you with one final, lingering question. It builds on Dr. Cefilli and Humberto Maturana's ultimate query. The paper asks, at a global civilizational level, how do we want to live together? But let's bring that massive question right down to your kitchen table, knowing what you know now about how unseen cultural distinctions shape our actual biology and dictate our future. What is one deeply held truth you are conserving right now that is secretly negating the life of someone you love? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.